Hi, my friends. Before we get into today's amazing conversation with Dr. Kristen Donnelly, I want to take a quick moment to remind you that there is still time to get in on my 14-day Build Your Mid-Career GPS Challenge that launches on Wednesday, September 15th. I'm inviting you to be a part of this challenge where I am going to walk you through step-by-step the same four quadrants around building your mid-career GPS that I talk about in my brand new book, and also to work with you on giving you specific, relevant, and tangible, easy to implement tips regarding your resume, LinkedIn, networking, and interviewing so I can help you figure out whatever is next for you and your career. Visit johnnarrell.com/book to learn more about my book and to get into the challenge. And also, I'll have a link to the challenge right here in the show notes for this episode. I hope you enjoy my amazing conversation with Dr. Kristen Donnelly. It is one you do not want to miss. Let's get started. Hi, I'm John Narrell, and welcome to the Mid-Career GPS Podcast. If you're feeling stuck in your career and overwhelmed by what steps to take, I can help you. As an executive and career transition coach, I help my clients prepare, position, and promote who they are and what they do to show up and find a job they love or love the job they have. It's time to start building your mid-career GPS. So let's get started. Hello, my friends. Welcome back to the podcast. Now, as leaders within your organizations at whatever title and capacity you hold, we know that every organization has opened up conversations and established initiatives around diversity, inclusion, and empathy. My guest today is going to challenge the concept of tolerance and share with us why she believes that diversity cannot be a goal because it already exists as long as we take the actual definition of diversity and broaden it beyond traditional uses. My guest believes that inclusion has to be a goal because that takes cultivation, vulnerability, curiosity, and honesty. And she also believes that shifting our thinking from diversity to intersectional inclusivity is one of the hardest things we will ever do, but it is the only way to save the world. I'm excited to introduce to you an empathy enthusiast, an unapologetic nerd, an educator, and a TEDx speaker. Dr. Kristen Donnelly is the founder at Abby Research, an organization who for over 20 years is based on the belief that every community of human is made more inclusive through curiosity and empathy. Abby Research provides concrete solutions to complex questions and helps organizations navigate change by learning new concepts and unlearning others, all in a safe environment without shame or guilt. Kristen is joining me today to talk about how you can be a more empathetic and inclusive leader. Kristen, welcome to the podcast.
My gracious, John, thank you so much. You are introducing me forever. I'm now hiring you. That was so great. So great. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
Well, it is an honor to have you here. And we recently just connected and the whole title of you being an empathy enthusiast was you were just someone I knew I wanted to talk to and bring onto this podcast today. We had a great call before this, and I know we're just going to have a wonderful time today. So Kristen, as we get started, I ask all of my guests this question because it's fascinating how we get to a certain place in our lives and careers. But share with my listeners, what did you want to be growing up?
A Broadway star.
Oh, sure. Talk to me.
Yeah, definitely wanted to be on Broadway. Did a lot of theater growing up. I think my first role, quote unquote, I was 3 in a church Christmas pageant. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's what I thought was going to be it. And then I hit adolescence and realized that my body is not a body that Broadway wanted, and shifted the gifts that I have for commanding an audience and, you know, not being afraid of any stage ever into some other things. I'd always loved teaching and speaking. And so I did, I don't know, I'm on career 19, I feel like right now, but they've all had something to do with serving people and telling them stories. Everything I've done has had that through line since I was three.
Well, and having a theater background and a theater passion, don't you think that just makes us better storytellers in some way?
My gosh, absolutely. Because first of all, we consume stories voraciously. Yeah. And we also have to consume them empathetically, because if you want to be a performer at all, you have to learn to walk around in other people's shoes. That's the whole point of performance. So, you know, I was in seventh grade and in Annie Get Your Gun, and we did a whole sixth grade. We did a whole exercise on what it would have been like for Annie to be the only woman in this really rough and tumble world. And I like got totally pushed outside my box as a sixth grader. And that kind of stuff happens all the time in theater world. And we also learn camaraderie in a different way. I think we learn that different skill sets are valuable. I mean, like, I don't know about you, but there's no way on God's green earth I could do anything without a stage manager. Right. And that skill set isn't less than the people who have their name in lights. It's actually more than, to be honest. Yeah. And so we understand team dynamics. I think, you know, sports people get all the credit for understanding teams. I understand teams perfectly. I had to put on shows. So yes. Yeah.
A favorite show you have ever done or seen?
No, not that. You can't ask me that.
No?
Favorite show I've ever done has been probably You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, because it was just so much fun.
I love that show.
And then favorite show I've ever seen, if we put Hamilton in its own category as a transcendent human experience, sure. I think my favorite, God, I've got a top five. Wicked is really special to me.
Yep.
Music Man is really special.
Same. Yep. Same.
My Fair Lady is really special. Mm-hmm. And I love Book of Mormon.
Oh, yeah. So, so on the edge of your seat, cringeworthy, yet hysterical and all that kind of stuff. Wrapped
and
up
as a person that grew up in faith and is still a faith-based person, I actually identify a lot with a couple of the main characters' journeys and how do we engage with faith, and how, like, I joke all the time, I could do a TED talk on the Book of Mormon musical. And Why I Believe is like one of the songs that I wish I would have had as a child. As I was navigating my faith. But yeah, no, I love it. That's the first musical I ever took my husband to, Book of Mormon. So that's also special in our marriage, because he was like, oh, I don't like musicals at all. And I was like, pause, you grew up in rural Northern Ireland. Have you seen a musical? Like, just a question. You grew up during a time of war. Have you seen a musical? No. Okay, well, I'll bet you money. I was speaking in London while the original cast in London was on. So Gavin Creel and a couple other really incredible. I remember Gavin Creel like a lightning bolt. And I was like, I will buy the ticket. You have to give me the intermission. And if you hate it at intermission, you get to leave and I will never ask you to come to a musical again. By song two, he had tears running down his face. He was laughing so hard. And now we are like, now we go to everything. We have tickets now to go see Jeremy Jordan in Little Shop of Horrors at the end of October. So I converted him with Book of Mormon.
Nice. Well, my husband is a big theater nerd as well. And so we have this deal that there are shows we will see together. That, like, it's a must, right? Like,
yes,
our first show we ever saw together was Wicked,
right? So good.
But then, like, if there's other stuff that I'm not as interested in seeing, I'm like, he has other friends to go see with and stuff.
Yeah, so I'm the year husband in our relationship. Yes. So, like, we have a subscription to the Philadelphia Theater Broadway program, and like, we'll look over the schedule, and he's like,
oh my gosh, we did the same thing. We were looking at the Kennedy Center schedule and the National Theater schedule. And we were like, we won't get the subscription, but we'll go see that show.
You know, yeah. That kind of thing. And then we're like, okay, and this show, we're going to just be donating the tickets. To a silent raffle or something. I very famously hate cats. So when it came through, I donated it to a silent raffle.
That is too funny. All right. So this just puts a whole different spin on things in some ways, right? So, you know, as an actor, as a performer, as an educator, as a speaker, and honestly, most importantly, as I'm getting to know you a little bit, as a change agent and a change advocate, right? You do so much work around empathy.
Mm.
How did you become what you call yourself as an empathy enthusiast?
Gracious. That is a little bit of a long story. So listeners, I apologize. I will attempt to summarize. The best way I know how to get into that answer is to tell you a little bit about my family, which is that we actually have a mission statement as a family, which is to impact lives and create wealth. And we've had that mission statement since 1991, when my father bought a, at the time, failing dye manufacturing company. And in a neighborhood in Philadelphia that has been historically under-resourced and the needed jobs. And so my dad's purpose that he bought with his business partner was to bring back no-skill manufacturing jobs to the neighborhood. If you could show up sober every day and on time, we would find you a job. And that has been the same for almost 31 years. And my brother and I now own the company together. We're now the second generation of this vision. But everything of my life since I was 7 years old has been about impacting lives and creating holistic wealth. Emotional wealth, physical wealth, spiritual wealth, economic wealth. What the question we're asked every year at Christmas is, what did you do this year to make someone's life better? I'm asked that question. I was away for college, and every conversation I had with my father was, what did you do this week to make someone else's life better? And that kind of combination, that alchemy that I grew up in, where I grew up in the Philadelphia suburbs. Anyone who knows Bucks County, that's where I grew up. It's very a very different world than the Kensington neighborhood where we own our factory. And I grew up with a little bit of a foot in both worlds. I understood that there were lots of systems that were in place that no matter how good a decision that you could make, there were systems that were against you. I learned very quickly and very firsthand kind of a little bit of what alcoholism looks like with some of our employees and how that works. I learned what a used condom looks like by stepping it over on the sidewalk at age 9. And then I'd go, and the biggest problem that my friends had was that we didn't, you know, like that they talked about sometimes, was they didn't get the thing they wanted for Christmas. And it was a lot of this very cognitive dissonance early on in my developmental years of that everybody's pain is valid. Everybody's story is valid. Everybody's life is valid. And to judge one group of people against another group of people is nonsense and doesn't get us anywhere. And that being my frame, subconsciously, to be completely frank, didn't really even realize it's what I wanted, but I would always get itchy when we were somewhere where people were talking about other people in a non-pragmatic or empathetic way. Like I'd always be the kid in the class that would be like, right, but they also deal with blah, 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 blah. I'd be the kid in my Sunday school classes being like, right, but how does this feed people? So like we have resources. The point of resources is to share them. So like, what do we do with that? And I was always that person. So then I grew up. I was a youth worker for a long time. And let me tell you, the biggest empathy builder is working with teenagers. God love them. Lived overseas, moved to Northern Ireland, sight unseen, actually right after college. And that's a huge piece of my story because I landed completely blind into a country that was in a frozen conflict and still is, and had to learn to understand people without condoning their actions. I'm at dinner with across the table from people who were in jail for murder. I'm, you know, shopping next to people whose parents were killed by somebody else across the street. And like, how do we navigate this life together, and watching how they chose to do it versus what I then went on to research and learn to be healthy, which is a huge part of now my speaking and everything else. So all of that, then I added a master's of social work degree. Social workers are the best. And that's essentially a degree in activated empathy. And it just kind of kept going. And I had a lot of other titles for a little while. Like titles are so weird. Really what they are is a shorthand of what you do, what you value, and how much control or power you have in your organization. Like that's it. I'm the COO of our parent company. What does that mean? I can sign checks. Like I still plug the toilet. I still, you know, plunge the toilet when it gets stuck. Like it's titles are weird. So we came up with empathy enthusiast, empathy educator is often how I identify myself, because when you drill down to the core of what I think the world needs, it is to view empathy as an intellectual posture and not an emotional response. If you move through the world empathetically, intellectually empathetically, and pursue understanding, not agreeing with, condoning, any of that. But if you move through the world changes. Because I've seen it in my life, and I've seen it in the lives of others, and I've seen it in 20 odd years of both academic and lay research.
There's so many good things that you shared there, and thank you for letting us in a little bit around that. I'm fascinated by this idea, and would like to just dig in a little more about this whole idea about empathy being a posture, right? Because for a lot of the people who I work with and who listen to this podcast, they have really big hearts.
Yeah.
They're heart-centered leaders.
Yeah.
But there's that piece that takes them to the next level. Right? It's that piece that allows them to go a little bit deeper or a little further in their leadership, their team building, their organizational presence, where exercising their empathy from that place of posture would be more beneficial for them.
I love the word posture for two reasons. Yeah. One, it's something I'm not good at. And so whenever I use it, I'm reminded of to straighten my physical posture, which is necessary. And second of all, it's a practice. Posture is always a practice. Very few of us are born with preternaturally excellent posture. If we have it, it's because we've exercised those muscles quite a lot. But it's how you carry yourself through the world. It's how you, when we say people have a dancer's body, we don't necessarily mean thin arms and legs. We mean how they move physically. And so I think as we physically move through the world with a posture of empathy, that's that next step of being a heart-centered leader. So being a heart-centered leader is somebody who has, because I love heart-centered leaders. Hi, everybody, you're wonderful. Being a heart-centered leader is having compassion and maybe even having empathy for situations, maybe even responding empathetically to situations, but it might not be the first thing. So an example would be if you have an employee who is a lot of drama, we all have them. So you have an employee who's a ton of drama and your knee-jerk reaction to them is always, ugh. And like, you may get yourself out of that and do really good empathetic things, but your knee jerk is, ugh. Having an empathetic posture, your knee jerk is the context that they live in. Your knee jerk is, man, like, I wonder if home is being really toxic again. I wonder if their back is acting up. I wonder if their blood sugar is out of control. I wonder if, you know, for instance, that they have really high health anxiety. I wonder if they read an article about COVID last night. Like, having an empathetic posture means your knee jerk is curiosity, not judgment or exhaustion.
So for the heart-centered leader or for the empathetic leader who works in an organization where their executive leadership or the people they work alongside don't advocate, or maybe the word I'm looking for is respect, the same kind of posture.
Okay.
What advice would you give for them?
Do it anyway.
Yeah.
That sounds so one thing I should say earlier, and you said in the intro that it's the hardest thing that, you know, it's one of the hardest things that we'll do. It's also really simple. It's difficult, but it's simple. You just do it. And the more, something else I've learned as I've studied this and I've studied how people's energies work. So your physical energy you put out in the world changes when you're an empathetic person, because you project that you're safe in a way that other people don't necessarily do. So as you continually practice this, people are going to know you're different. They're going to see something, you know, new about you. They're going to maybe, you know, engage. They're going to notice that you're the one that everybody goes to with problems, which you may or may not want, but that's a separate podcast we can come back about. And they're going to notice those things. And that's one of the ways to be a quiet change agent. Additionally, just because somebody doesn't respond the way that you want them to doesn't change your posture. Mm-hmm. When I say that we engage with everybody empathetically and we reject an idea of tolerance and instead actively engage with other humans, I don't mean that you're in relationships with everybody. I don't mean that like everybody is your BFF. All I'm saying is that tolerance is passive. Tolerance is saying like you are alive because it is illegal to kill you. Mm-hmm. Cool. Focusing on, and you usually, tolerance is usually about judging a person on 1 to 2 characteristics about them, honestly. Empathetic understanding is getting context for their whole person and then making an informed decision about your relationship with them. So in organizations that don't value this, I've never worked in corporate America. I need to be really honest. I never have. I went from academia into my family business. So there's a lot of kind of the messy contexts I get from other people. But from what I've heard and researched and learned and gilded, even the most toxic culture, if the culture is completely toxic, please look for another job and get out. And that's another podcast.
Right.
But if you can be a change agent within it, the best way to be a change agent is always to be kind. In corporate places where people are treated interchangeably and not like humans, you stand out by being kind.
Right. What's coming up for me as I'm listening to you is that there have been, this is not a badge of honor, it's just a data point, but there have been times in my career where I have terminated people.
Mm.
And terminating employees is never an easy thing to do.
Nope.
It is also sometimes the best thing for them and for the organization, right?
Because
the fit's no longer there.
Yeah.
And I remember dealing with this one particular situation. And when the announcement had come out, somebody on my team said to me, well, that took you long enough. Mm-hmm. And I said, what did you mean by that? And they were like, well, come on, you had to have known this was going on. Like I can't, we just can't believe it took you this long. And I said, look, I cannot share details or specifics around the case, but I will share this with you. If the roles were reversed, I would have want the same thing done to me.
Mm.
And they were like, okay, I get it. They were like, they understood the process from my lens, even though it may not have completely aligned or agreed with executive leadership's timeline.
Yeah.
I mean, you're bound by laws, you're bound by
processes. Yeah. I mean, there's realities like we live that. In, folks. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. But that whole notion of being kind is a posture, to use your language, right? That helps especially mid-career leaders navigate through their situations that very closely align to who they are as a professional and their values.
Yeah. And there's all these, you know, Instagram adages that we can throw out at this point, you know, you know, be kind because everyone, you know, is fighting a harder battle. Like, you know, that's, and the one I think about a lot is, you know, no one will remember what you said. They'll remember how you made them feel.
Right.
And the reason these things are adages is because they're true. Mm-hmm. And that is, and you are only responsible for your own behavior.
Yeah.
I've been in lots and lots of toxic situations where I remember the person who wasn't.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Oh, so well said. All right. So we talked a little bit about empathy. I want to bring in the whole concept here about diversity.
Got it.
You have very strong,
I do,
powerful research and opinions and outlooks and thoughts and stuff around diversity. So here's the question. Why can't diversity be a goal?
Because it's already a reality. Like, yeah. this is the thing. So I need to stop saying the word so. When you all meet me the next time on a podcast, hopefully I will have improved. That's a major
goal. I struggle with that as well. I have gone back and listened to a couple and I hear so a lot. So brother and sister here on this.
Yeah, it's like my favorite vocal stop somehow. My business partner calls me out on it all the time, as she should. We have narrowed the definition of diversity, especially in the United States, but then everything we do bleeds everywhere else. We have narrowed diversity to mean Black people and white people. And we have, that is not true. That's not what diversity is. That's not how we achieve anything. Diversity is understanding that every single human being is already diverse, and therefore every room you are in is already diverse, because every human being is an intersectional entity. What do I mean by intersectional? Intersectionality was a term coined by Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw in the late 1980s. She's incredible. Please follow her work if you don't know her, because she was trying to explain that Black women are not just Black people or women. They are Black women. And that particular intersection of identities is a separate identity from Black people and women. Like, there's a specific thing. So I, for instance, because y'all can't see me, I am white. I am middle class. I'm educated. I'm married. I'm cisgendered. I'm heterosexual. And those are all that particular alchemy makes me who I am. I could be in a room of all white people and still be in an incredibly diverse environment. I tell the story all the time. When I was in college, I was on a leadership committee, and it was a small evangelical college in central Kentucky where I had a great experience. And there was a lot of talk about making sure we were diverse. And I knew that they just meant racial, because they're like, well, we don't have a very diverse campus. And I was like, well, that's crap, because I am one of the only people here who was born above the Mason-Dixon line. I'm one of the only people here whose family owns a business. I'm one of the only people here who is a Democrat, which was a very, very specific thing at that time. That's a lot of diversity. I can bring a lot of opinions to the table that have nothing to do with race. And by flattening it, and then I hear from my Asian and Indigenous and Latina friends that when we say diversity, we don't mean them either. We just mean the number of Black people and white people in a room, really. We've then flattened it to where we can pretend it can be a workshop exercise. And we can come together and have, and make friends, and that's good. And then we've achieved something. All, unfortunately, we've achieved is continuing to ignore the diversity that we have within us. So what I would like us to do instead is focus on inclusivity. Mm-hmm. Inclusivity is an active recognition of all of that diversity. It is not, it's having room at the table for everybody to bring their full selves, whatever they want to bring to the table. I have a Black executive friend who always says she never wants to bring her Blackness to the table. She really wants to bring her advocacy as a disability advocate. But she's never invited to tables because she has a special needs son. She's invited to tables because she's a Black COO. And it drives her nuts. She wants to talk about that. That's just one person. But if that's one person who's making a really valid point, she's not alone, and we can kind of look out. And so tolerance drives me insane. I already kind of explained why. Every time somebody says we need more diversity, my immediate question is, what diversity do you already have? Have you activated and investigated that? You might need more diversity, possibly. But I first want to know what you have and how you're leveraging it. And like when I do workshops on this, I always do diversity bingo, where I have people walk around the room and get signatures. And it's everything from grew up in a single parent home to grew up in a farming community to has a passport. Only about 30% of Americans have a passport. If you have a passport and you use it, that makes you really, that brings a different perspective to the table of things. Do you read Harry Potter? Do you know what Liverpool Football Club is? These are all things that can make you diverse. Did you lose a parent when you were young? Did you lose a child? Are you divorced? Were you cheated on? All of these things are things that form who we are. And we're able to have this conversation now in a really beautiful way, because I think as a society, we have understood that you really can't do the don't bring home stuff to work anymore. We've said that that's exhausting. It doesn't serve anybody. It's incredibly masculine driven, where all they had to do was show up at work because everything was being taken care of at home. That's of the past. The future is authentic self at all times with self-controlled boundaries. And part of that self-control boundary is allowing people to bring their selves to the room, to the decision-making room. And every piece of research out there says the more diverse a company's decision-making team is, the stronger the company is, the more revenue it has, the longer employees keep, like all of those statistics. But that's not just racial diversity. That's activating the richness of the diversity you already have.
When you take those moments and you become more aware of the extensive and expansive diversity that you have on your team within your organization, there's another component there in that for leadership, it's about creating that safe space.
For sure.
For everybody involved. What tips do you have for my listeners to help them create an even safer space, be it even just on their team or in their department, so they can show up as more authentic leaders?
utterly fantastic question. And my answers are going to be utterly frustrating because my first answer is to listen more, to know what diversities they have there. Mm-hmm. Also to remember that when I talked about self-done boundaries, there are things in your workers' lives they don't want to bring to the table. Like you still have to be a secret keeper. Like it doesn't matter if you think that somebody should bring this thing. It matters if they want to or not. Your job is not necessarily to create the diversity. Your job is like John said, create the space for that to exist. So that is also, you know, building trust, having conversations. I've discovered often that like asking questions usually gets you eventually to the answers that you want. Yes. So is there somebody around you? Is there a team member that you know, for instance, is a practicing Muslim? Maybe ask them like, hey, I know Eid's coming up. Is that something you want us to celebrate? Mm-hmm. They get to say yes or no. No, I don't really want it. Okay, great. But they know in that conversation that you want their full selves. Maybe if you have a really small organization, maybe it's also sending birthday cards to their kids, spouses, or family members, and not just them. It's whatever way that you can say, hey, I see you. It's making sure that your policies for parental leave potentially, first of all, apply to anyone who identifies as a parent. Mm-hmm. And second of all, maybe also includes caregiver leave. It's providing, if you provide toilet paper to your employees for free, you should also be providing period products. Yes. Because those are just as mandatory. So they're just as, you can't opt out of them either. So you should be providing those. What does all of those little things look like? The little pragmatic things. When you guys do a holiday celebration, do you call it a Christmas party? Are the only colors red and green? Do you only have a tree? All of these kind of things. Do you have a Biggest Loser competition every January? Please, first of all, lots of research says, please don't do that.
Yeah, please second of all,
that's really, really exclusive to anybody who doesn't want to participate in that. And then also breeds a culture of judgment for anyone who doesn't. So there's lots of ways to do it. But the best way I know is not to sit down and be like, right, so we're going to activate diversity and you are this tick box. And now I need you to show up in the meetings and talking like this, which I've heard of happening.
I have heard of that too. And I'm laughing because it's uncomfortable. It's sad. It is. And it's shocking that still exists in some way.
And it's unnecessary because a whole lot easier reframe is, hey, like I heard, like, hey, you mentioned once that this is part of your life. Tell me more about that. I have a friend who is a startup CEO, and he was at a really toxic Fortune 100. I think they were classified as that, and ended up leaving and starting his own show. And one of the things that he decided to do first off was that everybody throughout the course of a month had a cup of coffee or a meal with him. Until they reached 50 employees, and then he was going to empower like other people. But even after that, they're at like 125 now. Once a year, he has coffee or a meal with every single person that works with them. And the entire policy is that they get to ask him whatever they want, and he gets to ask them whatever he wants.
Nice.
And it's never about work. It's never, ever about work. It's always about your humanness. And he's like, there's been times that I've sat there and I've gotten one word answers from folks. And that tells me a lot. Like, and I don't need their story. I don't need anything else. I just want them to know that I want it if they want to give it. And that to me is a really, it's not his personality really works with that. That is his gifting. He's a trained social worker. He loves doing all of that. So some of you may be listening to that and being like, that literally sounds like a circle of hell. It's probably not for someone on your team. So maybe like these are the conversations we have is, hey, who's really good at conversations? How do we all get to know each other? What does this look like? How do we help the introverts feel belonging without making them go to parties where they have to make small talk? Like all of these kind of things are questions you should be asking if you want to make a more actively inclusive environment.
Yeah. My takeaway from this part is, so as a former manager who had direct reports, I treasured check-in meetings. I'm a firm believer that check-in meetings need to be held with fidelity, and they're not just for talking about work.
Yeah,
that they're there to build trust and rapport and relationships with the people on your team. And my pet peeve is that if you cancel a check-in meeting for whatever reason, within 24 hours, you need to reschedule that check-in meeting.
Yeah.
Right. You need to hold that space. And so for anybody listening, if you have these kind of check-in meetings in place, Kristen has given you some wonderful things to start opening up the conversation a little bit differently. So it isn't always just about work. It is about seeing them and recognizing them, and more importantly, getting to know them as a human being who you happen to spend 8-10 hours a day with, depending on how stressful your work life situation is, to really build that rapport and relationship with them. And that to me sounds like a powerful thing.
I think it'd be fun. Get one of those books of questions from Barnes and Noble, or like a box of questions, and just have them pick one. Those are usually silly. Like, play a game of would you rather, you know, there's a lot of ways. Icebreakers in groups give lots of people anxiety. Icebreakers one-on-ones gives less people anxiety. Yes. And so, you know, think about it that way.
Yeah. Nice. Well, as we start wrapping up here, I always like to end the conversation with, what advice would you give someone to help them build their mid-career GPS at this stage in their lives and careers?
Be gentle with yourself. The person that you were 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 30 years ago was doing the best they could. And being ashamed of them, judging them, now you need to hold them accountable potentially, but being ashamed of them and carrying around that does no one any good, including you. And so especially I'm talking about potentially opening up some difficult conversations. It's possible that you're going to be talking to people of color about reparations. It's possible that you'll end up having a conversation with Indigenous folks, especially if you're listening in Canada, about what do we do about residential schools. We're going to have that conversation in America too. These can be ugly, painful conversations. And it's, you are most likely going to offend somebody. Somebody is going to offend you. That is how this is going to work. We are messy human beings navigating a very messy time in human history. As you learn, do differently and be gentle with who you were before. Because except for very rare occasions, we're generally all doing our best.
Well said. I like that a lot. Well, Kristen, I have so enjoyed spending this time with you today and getting to know you a little bit. I look forward to staying in touch with you and following your work. For anybody who is listening, how can they get in touch with you? Where can they hear you speak? Where can they follow you? Give us all of the details on how they can connect.
Well, you can hear me speak at your organization if you want to book me. First of all, we love talking to, my business partner and I love having workshops and keynotes and lunch and learns and corporate retreats and unpacking all of this stuff in your particular context. So first of all, there's that. Second of all, we put up like 5 YouTube videos a week and we have a podcast. So if you would like to hear us in your ear holes, it's called The Culture Cast. The link will be below. We cover popped and lived culture in order to help you build your empathy about things you may not have encountered, like how to build empathy through watching Falcon and Winter Soldier or through watching Bridgerton. And then on the YouTube channel, we also do a really long series called The Colonizers World Tour. And we're going around the world and talking about the legacy of colonization in different countries. And as managers, the likelihood that you will be encountering people with emotional or physical ties to other nations, I don't know, I think is like 90% accuracy. So knowing about other cultures, we think, is a big piece of having an empathetic posture. As John and I are talking right now, it's the end of July. We are talking about Haiti coming up soon. And there's lots of Haitian Americans and Haitian diaspora in the United States. So educating yourself about home countries is also a big part of it. We are at Abbey Research, ABBEY, research like it's spelled, on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, not TikTok, but just about everywhere else. Find us there and we'd love to talk.
Awesome. Well, I will make sure all of that is linked up in the show notes. Kristen Donnelly, it has been an absolute pleasure. And once again, thanks so much for sharing with us about how we can all be a little bit more empathetic and push these conversations around diversity in our lives and our careers. Unquestionably, you added so much value today. And on behalf of me and all my listeners, really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
You are a gift. Thank you for the honor. I look forward to hearing from everybody what you learned.
All right. And remember, everybody, as I say all the time, we build our GPSs one step or 1 mile at a time. And remember, how we show up matters. Make it a great rest of the day. If you enjoyed today's show and don't want to miss an episode, follow on Apple Podcasts or wherever you usually listen. And I'd appreciate it if you would leave a rating and review. Visit johnnarrell.com to download your free copy of the 55-Minute Career Transition Jumpstart to help you start building your mid-career GPS. And don't forget to connect with me on LinkedIn and follow me on social @JohnNarrellCoaching. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.